Chapter 13. Herder gave a little laugh of glee. They sprang off and started to walk back up the hill. Ethan dragged the sled with one hand, and passed the other through Maddie's arm. "Were you scared I'd run you into a elm?" he asked with a boyish laugh. "I told you I was never scared with you," she answered. The strange exaltation of his mood had brought on one of his rare fits of boastfulness. "It is a tricky place, though. The least swerve, and we'd never come up again. But I can measure distances to a hair's breadth always could." She murmured, "Colin, I always say you've got the surest eye." Deep silence had fallen with the starless dusk, and they leaned on each other without speaking. But at every step of their climb, Ethan said to himself, "Colin, it's the last time we'll ever walk together." They mounted slowly to the top of the hill. When they were abreast of the church, he stooped his head to her to ask, "Colin, are you tired?" And she answered, breathing quickly, "Colin, it was splendid." With a pressure of his arm, he guided her toward the Norway spruces. "I guess this sled must be Ned Hale's. Anyhow, I'll leave it where I found it." He drew the sled up to the Varnum gate and rested it against the fence. As he raised himself, he suddenly felt Maddie close to him among the shadows. "Is this where Ned and Ruth kissed each other?" she whispered breathlessly, and flung her arms about him. Her lips, groping for his, swept over his face, and he held her fast in a rapture of surprise. "Goodbye, goodbye," she stammered, and kissed him again. "Oh, Matt, I can't let you go," broke from him in the same old cry. She freed herself from his hold, and he heard her sobbing. Oh, I can't go either," she wailed. "Matt, what'll we do? What'll we do?" They clung to each other's hands like children, and her body shook with desperate sobs. Through the stillness they heard the church clock striking 5. "Oh, Ethan, it's time," she cried. He drew her back to him. "Tea time for what? You don't suppose I'm going to leave you now? If I miss my train, where'd I go? Where are you going, if you catch it?" She stood silent, her hands lying cold and relaxed in his. "What's the good of either of us going anywheres without the other one now?" he said. She remained motionless, as if he had not heard him. Then she snatched her hands from his, threw her arms about his neck, and pressed a sudden drenched cheek against his face. "Ethan! Ethan! I want you to take me down again." "Down where?" "The coast. Right off," she panted. "So T will never come up anymore." "Matt, what on earth do you mean?" She put her lips close against his ear, to say "Colin" right into the big elm. "You said you could. So T we'd never have to leave each other anymore." "Why, what are you talking of? You're crazy." "I'm not crazy, but I will be if I leave you." "Oh, Matt, Matt," he groaned. She tightened her fierce hold about his neck. Her face lay close to his face. "Ethan, where'll I go, if I leave you? I don't know how to get along alone. You said so yourself just now. Nobody but you was ever good to me. And there'll be that strange girl in the house, and she'll sleep in my bed, where I used to lay nights and listen to hear you come up the stairs." The words were like fragments torn from his heart. With them came the hated vision of the house he was going back to, of the stairs he would have to go up every night, of the woman who would wait for him there. And the sweetness of Maddie's avowal, the wild wonder of knowing at last that all that had happened to him had happened to her too, made the other vision more abhorrent, the other life more intolerable to return to. Her pleading still came to him between short sobs, but he no longer heard what she was saying. Her hat had slipped back, and he was stroking her hair. He wanted to get the feeling of it into his hand, so that it would sleep there like a seed in winter. Once he found her mouth again, and they seemed to be by the pond together in the burning August sun. But his cheek touched hers, and it was cold and full of weeping, and he saw the road to the flats under the night, and heard the whistle of the train up the line. The spruces swathed them in blackness and silence. They might have been in their coffins underground. He said to himself, "Colin, perhaps it'll feel like this. Dot, and then again colon after this, I shan't feel anything. Dot, suddenly he heard the old sorrel whinny across the road, and thought colon he's wondering why he doesn't get his supper. Dot, come, Maddie whispered, tugging at his hand. Her somber violence constrained him. She seemed the embodied instrument of fate. He pulled the sled out, blinking like a night bird as he passed from the shade of the spruces into the transparent dusk of the open. The slope below them was deserted. All Starkfield was at supper, and not a figure crossed the open space before the church. The sky, swollen with the clouds that announce a thaw, hung as low as before a summer storm. He strained his eyes through the dimness, and they seemed less keen, less capable than usual. He took his seat on the sled, and Maddie instantly placed herself in front of him. Her hat had fallen into the snow, and his lips were in her hair. He stretched out his legs, drove his heels into the road, to keep the sled from slipping forward, and bent her head back between his hands. Then suddenly he sprang up again. "Get up," he ordered her. It was the tone she always heeded, but she cowered down in her seat, repeating vehemently, colon, "No, no, no. Get up. Why? I want to sit in front." "No, no. How can you steer in front?" "I don't have to. We'll follow the track." They spoke in smothered whispers, as though the night were listening. "Get up. Get up," he urged her, but she kept on repeating, colon, "Why do you want to sit in front?" Because I want to feel you holding me," he stammered, and dragged her to her feet. The answer seemed to satisfy her, or else she yielded to the power of his voice. He bent down, feeling in the obscurity for the glassy slide worn by preceding coasters, and placed the runners carefully between its edges. She waited while he seated himself with crossed legs in the front of the sled. Then she crouched quickly down at his back and clasped her arms about him. Her breath in his neck set him shuddering again, and he almost sprang from his seat. But in a flash he remembered the alternative. She was right. This was better than parting. He leaned back and drew her mouth to his. Just as they started, he heard the sorrel's whinny again, and the familiar wistful call, and all the confused images it brought with it, went with him down the first reach of the road. Halfway down there was a sudden drop, then a rise, and after that another long delirious descent. As they took wing for this, it seemed to him that they were flying indeed, flying far up into the cloudy night, with Starkfield immeasurably below them, falling away like a speck in space. Dot dot, then the big elm shot up ahead, lying in wait for them at the bend of the road, and he said between his teeth, colon, "We can fetch it. I know we can fetch it." As they flew toward the tree, Maddie pressed her arms tighter, and her blood seemed to be in his veins. Once or twice the sled swerved a little under them. He slanted his body to keep it headed for the elm, repeating to himself again and again, colon, "I know we can fetch it," and little phrases as he had spoken ran through his head and danced before him on the air. The big tree loomed bigger and closer, and as they bore down on it, he thought, colon, "It's waiting for us. It seems to know." But suddenly his wife's face, with twisted monstrous lineaments, thrust itself between him and his goal, and he made an instinctive movement to brush it aside. The sled swerved in response, but he righted it again, kept it straight, and drove down on the black projecting mass. There was a last instant when the air shot past him like millions of fiery wires, and then the elm. Dot dot, the sky was still thick, but looking straight up he saw a single star, and tried vaguely to reckon whether it were Sirius, or the effort tired him too much, and he closed his heavy lids and thought that he would sleep. Dot dot, the stillness was so profound that he heard a little animal twittering somewhere nearby under the snow. It made a small frightened cheep like a field mouse, and he wondered languidly if it were hurt. Then he understood that it must be in pain. Pain so excruciating that he seemed, mysteriously, to feel it shooting through his own body. He tried in vain to roll over in the direction of the sound, and stretched his left arm out across the snow. And now it was as though he felt, rather than heard, the twittering. It seemed to be under his palm, which rested on something soft and springy. The thought of the animal's suffering was intolerable to him, and he struggled to raise himself, and could not because a rock, or some huge mass, seemed to be lying on him. But he continued to finger about cautiously with his left hand, thinking he might get hold of the little creature and help it. And all at once he knew that the soft thing he had touched was Maddie's hair, and that his H, and was on her face. He dragged himself to his knees, the monstrous load on him moving with him as he moved, and his hand went over and over her face, and he felt that the twittering came from her lips. Dot dot, he got his face down close to hers, with his ear to her mouth, and in the darkness he saw her eyes open, and heard her say his name. "Oh, Matt, I thought we'd fetched it," he moaned. And far off, up the hill, he heard the sorrel whinny, and thought Cole and I ought to be getting him his feed. Dot, 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 dot. The querulous drone ceased as I entered Frome's kitchen, and of the two women sitting there I could not tell which had been the speaker. One of them, on my appearing, raised her tall bony figure from her seat, not as if to welcome me, for she threw me no more than a brief glance of surprise, but simply to set about preparing the meal which Frome's absence had delayed. A slatternly calico wrapper hung from her shoulders, and the wisps of her thin gray hair were drawn away from a high forehead, and fastened at the back by a broken comb. She had pale opaque eyes which revealed nothing and reflected nothing, and her narrow lips were of the same sallow color as her face. The other woman was much smaller and slighter. She sat huddled in an armchair near the stove, and when I came in she turned her head quickly toward me, without the least corresponding movement of her body. Her hair was as gray as her companion's, her face as bloodless and shriveled, but amber-tinted, with swarthy shadows sharpening the nose and hollowing the temples. Under her shapeless dress her body kept its limp immobility, and her dark eyes had the bright witch-like stare that disease of the spine sometimes gives. Even for that part of the country the kitchen was a poor-looking place. With the exception of the dark-eyed woman's chair, which looked like a soiled relic of luxury bought at a country auction, the furniture was of the roughest kind. Three coarse china plates and a broken-nosed milk jug had been set on a greasy table scored with knife cuts, and a couple of straw-bottomed chairs, and a kitchen dresser of unpainted pine stood meagerly against the plaster walls. "My, it's cold here. The fire must be most out," Frome said, glancing about him apologetically as he followed me in. The tall woman, who had moved away from us toward the dresser, took no notice. But the other, from her cushioned niche, answered complainingly, in a high thin voice, "It's only just been made up this very minute. Zena fell asleep, and slept ever so long, and I thought I'd be frozen stiff, before I could wake her up, and get her to tend to it." I knew then, that it was she who had been speaking when we entered. Her companion, who was just coming back to the table with the remains of a cold mince pie in a battered pie dish, set down her unappetizing burden without appearing to hear the accusation brought against her. Frome stood hesitatingly before her as she advanced. Then he looked at me, and said, "Colin, this is my wife, Mrs. Frome." After another interval he added, turning toward the figure in the armchair, "Colin, and this is Miss Maddie Silver." Dot 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 dot. Mrs. Hale, tender soul, had pictured me as lost in the flats, and buried under a snow drift, and so lively was her satisfaction on seeing me safely restored to her the next morning, that I felt my peril had caused me to advance several degrees in her favor. Great was her amazement, and that of old Mrs. Varnum, on learning that Ethan Frome's old horse had carried me to and from Corbury Junction through the worst blizzard of the winter. greater still their surprise when they heard that his master had taken me in for Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.